I want to just mention, talk about harm reduction, and then we're going to talk about self-harm. Harm reduction originated, do you remember Nancy Reagan's Just Say No idea, which was that to get kids to stop using drugs, you should just tell them no, and then they're going to stop using drugs. Actually, this is the anniversary of the war on drugs, and there's a lot of press right now about what an unbelievable abject failure it was. And but in any event, the harm reduction idea came about sort of as an idea for helping and supporting adolescents in the substance abuse world. But I've kind of thought as a treatment principle, it's one that I use much more broadly. And in harm reduction, they say the best should not be the enemy of the good, which means that yes, it would be great to stop cutting. It would be great to stop smoking. It would be great to stop drinking and drugging. These are laudable goals, having unprotected sex, whatever the thing that the kid's doing in some kind of repetitive way. But do you see any value in them doing less of that thing? Is there any benefit, discernible benefit, to making some better choices? Choosing not to get drunk, choosing not to smoke, choosing not to have unprotected sex, whatever it is. And I say, yeah, because as they're practicing that, you can be bringing other skills and relationships and knowledge, self-knowledge, on board. And so that every time an adolescent feels like self-harming and doesn't, or feels like getting loaded and doesn't, there's a new horizon that opens up. And so I think harm reduction is a very interesting adolescent idea. And it's consistent with what I talked about earlier about choices and responsibility, that if you choose yourself to not do something that is harmful, you're making a good choice. And isn't it interesting? Tell me more about that good choice. I'm curious, you know, wow. And then you unpack that and expand on that, because then they see, oh, I can choose not to do it. It turns out adolescents don't like being told what to do. Mm-hmm. So if it's their choice, then you're in a whole new game. Do you know what I mean? Okay, so that's the harm reduction idea. I'm not going to do the guidelines. Here's a funny, another mouse cartoon. It's a mouse talking to another mouse saying, here, I'm sorry, here I am going on, and I haven't asked you a thing about being caught in a trap. This is us with our treatment goals and planning and parental agendas. Okay. Let's talk about cutting and self-harm for a little while. There's general agreement that it's pretty severely underreported, that it's much more common than it was a generation ago. Interestingly, in one of the high school studies that was done, a pretty large-scale study, there was no gender difference, and also a prevalence rate pushing 50% of kids who had done self-harming behaviors, boys and girls both, in the last year. Inpatient, those of you that are working in inpatient settings know that it's a higher rate than that in inpatients. In college campus studies, I've seen there's studies ranging from about 18% to 38% of college kids. I don't know at Smith if it's higher because women's school or not. What's your sense? Is it common, you think?
I think it's less common than when I was in high school.
Than in high school, yeah. So I mean, it might vary too, and increasing recently in more recent studies. And it seems to be more common in the gay, bisexual, boy and girl both population. There are pretty well documented, in my mind, pretty persuasive contagion effects. They're certainly getting a lot of media attention. There are many, many internet sites which are pro self-harm sites where kids can exchange and learn how to self-harm in new ways and get support for doing it as a coping mechanism. Most self-harming behavior is done privately, but it is because of this, the whole way it is framed now in the culture, it has much more support in the culture at large. It's lost its stigma. Yeah.
They have their own name. I don't know if it goes beyond.
What's the name?
The whole group of kids. Emo kids.
Yeah, and self-harm is or acceptance of some kinds of self-harming behaviors, or they get called the emo kids, or those are the ones
right,
that do that.
Cut.
Yeah, yeah.
That's different than the music. Is that connected?
Yeah.
Different,
yeah. It's more emo in... An emo kid is more a kid who wears black clothes and listens to more emotional music. That's interesting, too.
The fact kids sort of really defend that, like, say, just because I'm emo doesn't mean I cut, you know?
Yeah, okay, so they're distinguished, you know, yeah. So that's interesting, and there may, you know, so who knows whether, you know, where the labels come from within or without. What is true is that within social groups, it is viewed as appalling and aberrant depending on the group, or completely normative depending on the group. So if you're in a group of kids who are pretty high functioning and someone does it, they'll get ratted out and people will worry about them. If you're in a group where a lot of the kids are doing it, or kids who befriend each other in the hospital and then they stay friends afterwards and they support one another in doing that, and the longer that's true, the more normative it becomes, and actually the harder it is to intervene with. There does seem to be pretty large-scale effect in residential settings, boarding schools, colleges, detention centers, where there is not very much adult influence and tremendous amounts of peer influence. So that's the contagion piece of it. What do kids say about why they do it? That's the other thing, too, when we're talking about meaning-making. I will say this, that the distinction between self-harm to die, suicidality, and self-harm that we're going to be talking about now is really, I feel very clear about this, although there are kids who do both. But my experience in working with many, many girls over the years who self-harm, they are doing it to be able to live. They do not want to die, they want to be able to live. And they are, and I'm not defending it, I don't want you to say, oh, Marty's pro self-harm. But I am saying that it's a very, very immediately effective coping strategy for unfathomable psychic pain. It works. It's not a long-term solution, obviously, because you got to do it again. But in the short term, regardless of the rationale, it's effective. And it's people, you know, kids have an amazing dissatisfaction with body and self, particularly traumatized kids who don't have a value in what their body is like. I would say, and you can tell me if you think I'm being ridiculous, that it is socially encouraged. I'm going to say some words to you, and you tell me where the word ew, self-harm, comes up. Eyebrow plucking, body waxing, tattooing, piercing. No one's saying ew yet.
Depends where that piercing.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's interesting. So you...
Yeah.
Tongue is an ew.
Nipples
is an whatever. Okay, but I'm just saying there's some place. This is just it's right. So we're going to go ew here and ew there,
that's
and like there's some girl got in some conservative southern school pierced her nose with a tiny little piercing, and they honor student, and they suspended her because she said that she was a member of a church. ACLU got involved. This is a very recent case. She was a member of a small church. 3,500 members nationwide, called the Church of Body Modification. And it was a religious practice to, I'm looking at you because I thought you'd think that amusing. But you know, so she was allowed, reinstated in school and allowed to have her, for her religious practice of body modification. All I'm saying is that tanning, I'm sorry, there are a lot of things that we are doing to, high heel shoes.
Ew.
Ew, right? Okay, at what point is the boundary crossed? And clearly, it's not in the same place for everyone. I mean, you think the boundary is crossed with high heel shoes. Like, that is self-harming behavior. You should see what women's feet who do this look like. I mean, really? Right? I mean, I'm in agreement with that. But, right, okay, so anyway, my point is, why do we self-harm? Well, one reason is that the way in which our culture is giving messages to girls about beauty and about popularity and about fashion and about the value of their bodies, it's all could come together and say, why not self-harm? Isn't it amazing some people choose not to, given this? Trauma reenactment, dissociative, survivor guilt, I've worked with a subset of kids over the years who have trauma stories, and I'm interested because it is a dissociative, they get into that dissociative place and they harm. But then what they do is they take unusually good care of their wounds, which is not typical. And I'm interested because I think some kids do a trauma reenactment all the way through. So they harm their body, and then they take care, they soothe it and take care of it and put Neosporin and whatnot on it. And so the ritual has in it the traumatic reenactment and some repair also for some kids. Some kids seem to be reading the DSM and just going through every self-destructive act there is, and this is on the journey. I don't know. You've worked with them, right? In inpatient, in residential, in foster care kind of settings, you see kids. They've gone through the eating thing and the binging and purging, and now they're doing. You know, they seem to just be trying everything that is available to them to. And they learn from their peers, and the peers, they have their toolkit of self-soothing strategies is so pathetically limited to stuff that really ends up hurting them. I mean, they just don't have the resources or tools or support to cope in the world differently.
And it's all on the internet.
And it's all out, and it's socially sanctioned. Now, the endorphins theory is very interesting to me because I think that when you work with people who have done this who have been self-harming for a long time, people talk about, why do I keep losing my chalk? Like wandering around with it. People talk about this idea that when you have stress in your body, I don't know if anybody's ever broken a leg or had some kind of traumatic injury, but there's a period of time where you don't feel in pain very much. Has anybody had this happen? You know, I'm not talking childbirth, but I'm talking, you know, like if you break a leg. And what it turns out is that our bodies are very clever, and they produce something under stress and physical pain, which they call endogenous opioids. Does anybody run? Does anybody do running? Okay. Do you, when you hit a certain place in your running, you know, the runner's high thing. You know what I'm talking about? You're in pain, and then it feels great. Okay. So the runner's high is that. Endorphins kick in. Endorphins are opioids. It's the word you think it is. It's like a drug, but endogenous means that your body produces a drug itself. So people that do runner's high or people who have had physical injuries know that under certain kinds of conditions, your body kicks in and gives itself a buzz. Right, you know, does anybody else know what I'm talking about? You're the only one that's nodding here. Okay, so one of the theories here about self-harm, people who get it caught up in the cycle of it, they're in incredible pain, psychic pain. They get into a place where they self-harm. But in cutting yourself or all the other things that people do, you trigger in your body this response. Endorphins kick in, endogenous opioids, your brain gets flooded with a sensation of well-being and calm. And then, alack, it drops back down again and your life is still unbearably hard. And the pressure builds up again, and then you need, just like you would need, people, right? You know people are addicted to running, right? Don't you? Right? It's the same. I mean, to me, it's for that. They can't not do it because they're like missing the... Right? Am I right about it? Yeah. And I think it's the same. I mean, in a way, certainly, argument can be made running is a more adaptive way to get the buzz than cutting. But I know people who run pretty compulsively, and I don't know. They run injured, they run, you know, they can't stop, too. So whether that's an addictive thing or not, I don't know. But in any event, so the addictions, endorphin addictions theory is very interesting to me. And I think it's one of the reasons why people who have been cutting for a longer time, it's harder the longer they do it to, even if they have a toolbox of other resources, because they've been doing it for a long time in therapy for a while, they still end up in the same place of wanting that rush. You know, they miss it because it's an addictive thing. Anyway. Even though there are a lot, certainly those of you that are working in residential settings think that it's a sort of an attention-getting thing. Most of the studies that I've seen in my experiences, it's more of a shameful, private thing that one study said only about 4% of the kids they studied did it for attention. A guy named Matt Seligman, who has done a lot of research on self-harm in boys and girls, says in kind of these general terms, which I'm not sure I believe with, but it's interesting that it's very gendered, that boys who self-harm are doing it for thrills, that they do very edgy, dangerous, physically endangering, you know, driving too fast kind of things, and that the girls who do it are going for the rush, for pleasure, to escape pain. I don't know. So there's some gender attributes there. The last thing about that is that there is a sense for some kids that it's just self-punishment. I don't deserve to take care of myself. I deserve to be punished and to hurt myself.
Your opinion, I mean, those are all different ways to look at it. What's your opinion about why it's so effective?
Well, I think all of the above. It seems to be an effective stress reduction technique for people that use it. They report immediately after self-harming, they feel better than they felt before they self-harmed. And whether we think it's because they are doing traumatic reenactments, whether they're just impulsive people who are self-punishing or punishing other people, I don't know. I mean, or...
But it's effective because it reduces their
pain. It's effective in doing the thing that it sets out to do, which is to make the pain go away. And one of the things that most kids say right before they do it is that they're in a pretty dissociated state. So it's really a way to bring one who is disintegrating back to the present moment, too, because post-self-harming, you're awake and aware and in a more present state. Again, I'm not defending it, right? You're not hearing me being a self-mutilation or something. So this is what Matt Seligman got, you know, I'm sort of paraphrasing him here. These are some of the quotes that I extracted from one of his articles. Helps stress, relieves pain, gives me control, helps me escape from my problems, to stop bad thoughts, to numb out, to feel something, to vent anger, to show desperation, to show how much I need help, to feel connected to friends. Everyone does it. It's a popular thing to do. It's my drug to purge bad feelings, to reassociate. That's in the dissociative, right, kids? To calm myself, to show my scars. That's an interesting one, having kids show you, you know, because they tell stories about what was happening. It's sort of like hieroglyphics or something. To punish myself, to control or hurt someone else. So it's a big range of needs. It's a big range. And the only way you can find out what the adolescent you're working with, what it means to her, is how. Yeah, ask. And don't assume. Because we make a lot of assumptions about it, and we have our own reactivity to it. And I think that really the agenda, when we're talking about sort of intervention here, whoops. Okay, here we go. Methods. There's a lot of different methods. And whether... I'm talking more about cutting today, but I did a lot of consulting in some public schools in southern Vermont, in middle schools. There was an epidemic a couple years ago of skin erasing. I don't know if people have that where they are. Kids are erasing words and symbols into their arms with erasers. Like, they don't, not where you are, huh? That's not new anymore. That's old hat in school system, yeah. Talk to people in schools. Yeah.
The principal got up to the announcing thing and just said anybody that seems erasing themselves in scars will be dealt with by suspension.
Or do it on private parts of your body, which is where a lot of people self-harm. Yeah. Self-tattooing more.
Yeah, and it wasn't like a joyful thing. It really felt fell under self-harm. They were like these perfect, and they weren't just the circles. They were like filled in. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
mindset, I feel like, that goes along with that versus like a quick cutting release of endorphins.
Yeah. Yeah, even worse that you would sustain that practice on yourself. And There's a story there. You know, I think there's stories around, I worked with a kid who burned herself with cigarettes. And, she just enjoyed watching it. I mean, the whole thing was just very, very upsetting to me. And I had to really work very hard to stay with her and explore what it meant to her. And she had a lot to say about it and what it was and what her thinking was before and during and after it. And, you know, your artful, maybe your artful self-harmer, in a way, there might be more other kinds of resources, because she's not just doing an impulsive act, she's doing a much more focused, intentional act. In a way, you might have more latitude with getting her to try other things, because there's such a purposefulness, as opposed to completely dissociated. It's hard to imagine being both completely dissociated, I don't know, and that purposeful. So that might be a distinction for it. But people, there's one of the things around, you know about what they call suicide by police? Yeah. Right, so I mean, and that's a whole other thing too, getting other people to hurt you, setting it up, provoking other people. And I think that that's a self, that could be very easily looked at as a self-harm. So I want to tell you about best evidence practice and some of the things that I do. The major piece of this is, that's interesting, there's nothing particularly new or different on this page about increasing. It's true, though, in terms of antecedent control, that if you know about triggers or time of day and that kind of thing, sometimes just hearing the story of when it happens and stuff, like somebody that self-harms after school and no one's home, would the self-harm be reduced if they were doing something else after school and not alone? Or I worked with a young woman who had dropped out of college, and she was living back home with her silently warring parents. And her big trigger was, in fact, family dinner, because her mother would be banging dishes around and storming around, and the kid would say, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And the mom would say, "Nothing, just eat your dinner," you know. And the invalidation would just make the kid nuts, and she'd go self-harm after dinner. And so one of the antecedent controls was not having family dinner until the parents had marital therapy. You know, control that antecedent. Why put her through that? So the empathic frame, validate beliefs. She believes, in order to validate her beliefs, you don't have to be saying this is a good thing. You just have to be saying you understand that for her it's working and you want to know more about it. And you're not going to judge her or take it away from her. Right? You're not going to condemn her. And you know, in family therapy, we say something that I think is great. We say, every problem is a solution to another problem. Mm-hmm. And so there is a frame in which this behavior is solving something, right? Mm-hmm. And until you believe me on this, you're going to struggle against these kids to do this. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That for them, because she's going to feel crazy. You don't want her to feel crazy, alienated, invalidated, re-traumatized by you. So this kind of curious, receptive stance, also, again, in terms of containment, that you can hold it. I have had a couple situations with kids with infected wounds where I really freaked out. And I'm not proud of it, but I was like, we gotta go to the hospital right now. And sometimes you do, and some it's hard to look at. But I would say that over time, I wanna see stuff, and I want to say, that looks really painful, and I know that at the time you did this, it was all you had on board. And I really want to help you have other things on board for managing this, because that is, that's really scarring and bad for you. So how does it work for her? What are her meanings? Understand, that your curiosity will open up her need to talk about it, and again, open up ambivalence about it. There are kids who will not give it up for nothing. And that's true with eating disorders. It's true with a lot of stuff that kids do. Their level of commitment is so great that it's really hard to get the wiggle room. But most kids, I would say, are willing to try and engage with other ways of being in the world. and there are elements to it that are not working for them, including the fact that it's so painful for their families and disengaging from, depending on what their peer group is, but it's a very marginalizing, isolating practice, ultimately. So your therapeutic stance is a little paradoxical. You have to be able to convey to them that you get that the same behavior is both self-protective and self-injurious. And again, it's sort of holding the paradox of the, you know, holding the complexity of something in the room. And if you go one way or the other, every time that someone talks about how it's self-protective, you can say, yeah, it really helps you calm when you're upset and you hurt yourself to do it. Or if people are saying, or parents are saying, this is just so dangerous and terrible, you say, yes, it's very dangerous, it's not a good coping mechanism, and it helps soothe her in a time where she doesn't have other resources. So that you're really making this wider space for both discourses. Am I making sense? Usually by, you know, 3 o'clock I start babbling. Okay, so what do you ask? Where did you learn how to self-harm? How long have you been doing it? Where on your body do you do it? In a given week or a given day, how often? You're getting baseline data when you're interviewing for this. What does your self-harming mean to you? In what ways does it help you? What would be some disadvantages for you of giving it up? Right? So you're opening up that dialogue about what she's hanging on to about it. Tell me about the triggers. And by triggers, it's the whole range of antecedents, thoughts, feelings, body sensations that lead to that solution. Is there a time of day, a location? Are there particular kinds of internal or external stressors that are identifiable as triggers? Family conflict, a fight with a boyfriend. What effect does it have on your relationships? I spend a lot of time with this one because I want to contextualize it and stop it being a private thing that she's doing to herself that has no impact on anyone else. I want to embed her in a social web of meaning making. When you resist, now this gets into about resistance. So we've done all this groundwork, we know about it, we're curious, we know about the antecedents, we're understanding kind of contextually what's going on, its impact on her and on other people, plus and minus. And then I'm interested in this set of questions very much. So, because very unusual, even at the beginning of treatment, can you not find a time where they wanted to do it and they resisted? Usually, there is a time or a place, it's true. I was thinking about doing it last week and then my friend called and I went out. Or, you know, my show, you know, American Idol came on and I went and watched TV, whatever. So what do you tell yourself or do that works? So we're really unpacking the exception now. So let's talk about your resistance to it, because the temptation is strong. The voice of self-harm speaks very loudly. Come do this, you're going to feel better if you do. How do you, tell me about a time you've stood up to that voice and not listened to it. What was going on? What did you do differently? What did you say to yourself? What was going on before, during, after, when you resisted. And who is there out there to help you resist? Do you have anybody? Your friends, mentors, older siblings? Have they done things that have helped you before? What is that? Oh, well, yeah, if I call my friend, she says, let's go out, don't do that. Oh, so she's really a helpful in encouraging you to give it up. You with me? The narrative people also take the questioning a step further by locating it, the behavior of self-harm in the larger culture. And this interests me a lot also because just like with anorexia, it upsets me very much that we are treating these self-harming girls one at a time when the problem is so widespread, so endemic, and so socially sanctioned in the culture at large. So some narrative type questions are like this. Many girls are pushed around by traditional assumptions of beauty and compliance, and generations of women have been oppressed by these expectations. What percentage of the day out of 100% do you find yourself thinking about how you look? Right? So it's saying the culture is making you spend so much time doing this. How much time are you doing it? What percentage of the time would you say you are in charge of these traditional assumptions and expectations versus their being in charge of you? Are these thoughts coming out of your own head, or are you being like brain co-opted by this toxic culture? What does self-harm say to you to convince you it is on your side? How does it disguise its voice so you believe you have to do its bidding? Can you have there been times lately when you stood up against these traditional assumptions and expectations and rebelled against their wishes? Can you distinguish your own voice when you speak on your own behalf? What do you tell yourself when you refuse to cave in? So it's like sort of a resistance movement, standing up to oppression in a larger sense. Do you understand? That's kind of exciting. I like this stuff very much. Are there times when you would prefer to have a self-embracing lifestyle instead of a self-harming lifestyle? Is there any part of the complexity of the girl that wishes she could nurture herself and be nurtured and wants that for herself, even as she knows that she has this resource for self-harm? If you could put a voice to your self-harming or most meaningful scars, what would they say about you as a person in your life situation? These are nice, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I like these.
Have you found, I'm just sort of thinking about, because I've done some narrative approaches with some of the kids mm-hmm. I work with, and sometimes they look at me and they're like, what was that question again?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Because the
yeah.
language.
The languaging of it, yeah, they're like, they, what do you mean? I'm not talking to self-harming. Yeah, yeah, I know. Sometimes they're reluctant. They think you're. They look at you like you're nuts a little bit.
So sometimes they have to get out props to sort of.
Right. Well, and that's from the Gestalt people. You see all the time with the pillow and the. I think that this is, in a way, this runs counter to what I was saying earlier about persona theory, because it's these voices are all our voices, you know. So it's a way. It's a little bit different. I mean, and sometimes girls are, their identity is so interwoven with this, externalizing and making it not be part of their identity feels threatening to their core identity. And so I think with these kids, I say, look, I'm not making you give it up. I'm just wanting you to be in conversation with parts of yourself and parts of ways of knowing and taking care of yourself and having, we have all different ways of talking to ourselves. And one way that's helpful is to distinguish the voices. And I usually say, for example, I'm anxious, and when anxiety speaks to me, I know that it's coming along because it does these things. And I know I don't have an alter ego named anxiety. I know it's part of me, but I'm in a relationship to it, and I have choices I can make about how much it's going to take over my life. So I'm actually doing the same thing with you. I'm saying, you're in a relationship with self-harm. You're making choices and decisions about how you want to live on Earth and what kind of life you want to have and deserve to have. And in order for us to understand this better and so I can support you, I need to know what these voices sound like and what self-harm says, what self-harm... And usually I can sell it a little bit. But yeah, there's kids that they don't want to play. Because also, I think those kids, it'll be interesting to say, but I now that I'm saying this to you out loud, I think those kids are reluctant to give up self-harm, and they see where you're going. They're smart kids, and they smell a rat. Mm-hmm. They think, oh, you're trying to trick me into saying that it's not good for me. And so enabling them to be in a relationship with it, but you know that you're not asking them to have a divorce, you're just asking them to name the relationship. Mm-hmm. You can stay married to self-harm, but you have to understand that it's a very difficult marriage. But it's your choice if you want to, we can't make them give it up. So. I'm going to tell some strategies quickly, and then we're going to talk a little about social aggression, and then a little about sex. We have to be done at 4, so I'm going. This is the most, this is kind of very pragmatic and useful, I want to spend enough time on this particularly. Safety, obviously. If they're really harming themselves and endangering their health, that's, you're intervening to make sure they have strategies on board and cleansing techniques, and they have ways to be safe. And it sounds kind of appalling, but I mean, a lot of the kids I work with have little like self-harming kits, you know. And whether they're, you know, how dirty and gross they are is kind of a worth. Well, yeah, right, yeah, but you know, that's the reality here. So I begin with their reality. I don't begin with my reality because, you know, that won't serve anybody. I want to know, I want to live in this empathic space on a good day I can do this, where I think to myself, if I were this girl, I would behave exactly as she does. If I were she, I would do as she does. And so my way of trying to meaning make and understand her meaning is through this lens of, if I were this kid, this would make perfect sense to me. And my repulsion and pushing away and confusion and disgust serves me not even an iota at helping her feel felt. And it pulls me, and it's true. I mean, this is what diagnosing people, borderline and oppositional defiant, we have a way of doing this in our professions where we create the other. This is disgusting, this is repulsive, this is unacceptable, this is ugly, this is, you know, whatever it is. And every time we go to that space, we're not serving our clients particularly well. So if you stay in that empathic frame, it's connective because you're thinking to yourself, wow, what is the life and meaning making and understanding and solution that this is for this person, that it's so that she's committing to it like this? And so how do I keep her safe? Do people know, name some distraction activities that she could do as an intervention. What could somebody who feels like self-harming do instead of self-harming? Watch TV, play with an animal,
exercise,
take a shower. Oh yeah, I'll get to that in a minute. I have some controversy about that. She was saying holding ice. There's a whole positive substitution piece. I'm just thinking distraction, doing something that is non in the self-harming world. It's good for girls to have like a you know, index card or someplace where they've come up with a menu of distractions to try. Because sometimes with the impulse, if you can do just one thing for a couple minutes, the impulse passes, right? And with these really impulsive kids who get involved in this, distraction is great. I'll tell you the other thing about flow, this idea of flow, absorption. People who have things they do and get absorbed in, if it's television or being with a pet or with a friend or Facebook or whatever, they get absorbed in it and time passes in this other kind of exciting reading way, they are much less likely to self-harm. So finding things in a girl's life which are deeply distracting, like engagingly distracting, when it's possible. Self-soothing and co-regulation of affect. Who can be there to help you feel calmer? What are the things that you can do about breathing and yoga and meditation and mindfulness? Because it's true that a lot of dissociative, so you can't be both mindful and dissociative at the same time. So to the extent that these more mindful practices, intentionality, meditation, yoga, dance, things where you're living inside your own body seem to be helpful. Now the positive substitution thing, there is a school of thought out there that says this, that squeezing ice or snapping a rubber band on your wrist are what people call positive substitutions because it causes harm, it releases the endorphins theoretically without the scarring. That's the theory behind it. And a lot of people over the whole country say this every time I talk about self-harm. I'll tell you my thought on it. I'm not telling you what to do. I don't prescribe that, I don't recommend that, because I think that to the extent that this is an addictive cycle, you're not substituting it with something else. You're actually just giving methadone instead of heroin. Now, it's possible that it still is better than that. So I'm not saying it's not, but I don't see, maybe so it's a step-down thing. But to me, I don't do that because I'm interested in positive substitution in the sense that, and I'll give you an example of one, that you are replacing the desire to self-harm with the desire to self-care. And one intervention that I've had some good success with on several occasions is I go out and I get like a little loofah sponge, a nice sponge, you know, a soft little sponge. And I ask the girl when she feels like self-harming to try this, to go into the bathroom and stay present. This is somebody I've worked with for a while, right? We have that. She knows the difference between present and dissociative state. She knows the difference between wise mind and dissociated mind. And she's in control enough still at that time to choose to try this. So she runs warm water onto the sponge and drips it down her arm and feels the warm, tender, loving water as opposed to blood and pain. And is conscious and aware instead of dissociated and just spends time soothing herself and comforting herself that way. And I think of that as more, you know, of a positive substitution than the holding the ice. But a lot of people subscribe to the holding the ice. So I'm just telling you what my thinking about that is. And other kinds of positive substitutions that people do is paint. With your art artiste, maybe making art, making body art, henna stuff, you know, instead of not tattooing, but you know, the temporary painting stuff. So I mean, it'd be interesting to see if that would have some satisfaction in being creative instead of destructive, but on the body also. People understand what I'm getting at?
Girls who will take like the red Sharpie marker.
Red Sharpies.
Because they'll talk about that sort of holistic sense of seeing it, feeling it when they cut the marker.
Great. A Sharpie, beautiful positive substitution, the Sharpie. Also, Sharpie sticks around for a while, so you get to hold on to it if that's what you need. Yeah. It's not self-harming. It's not, I mean, I would say that.
I wouldn't say that's self-love.
I would.
My own bias, maybe.
No, I would, because it's a conscious choice not to harm. What's more loving than that for someone who wants to do that and is trying to live differently in the world? But is still committed to looking at their body as something objectified and dissociative in a way. So while you're doing that and they're getting this other skill set on board, maybe they're self-harming less, and so they're living in the world and in relationship more. And so every time that their brain doesn't juice that way, because this is not going to juice. I can't imagine unless they're making beautiful, juicy art or something, but. It's not going to be. It's not. I don't think if they're going to get the marker high, it's right. The huffing the markers. Okay. Mindfulness, problem solving, recognizing, avoiding triggers, improving self care. That's an interesting thing. I mean, I think that a lot of these kids, they don't really know how to take care of themselves. They don't know. I mean, and this drives me nuts because people. One of the things that people always say, and it seems so sexist, but it actually seems to have legs in the literature, is this whole like manicure thing.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, getting a kind of thing where you doing your nails or getting your nails done, where you're dunking your nails in the gooey stuff. And the, I mean, I never do this, so I know anything about it, but you know what I'm talking about. And I'm resistant to it because it seems like this is what they say, you know, it's like this t-shirt, you know, to me a little bit like, oh, go do girly things and you'll feel much better. But apparently that's one of the girly things that does make you feel better.
Some people, you know, I think it's important to say for some people that makes you feel good.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Our self-soothing and self-care really varies. There are some people that need much higher intensity movement to feel better and some people that need to sit quietly and have their nails done. So part of it, figuring out what this alternative toolbox looks like and develop, is really very individualized. So that for me, fly fishing would do the trick, but most kids that I work with, they're like, ew, you know.
Just super quick, I was just going to say as an anecdote that my mom had actually had a lot of feet surgeries when she was a kid, very, very sensitive, and had a lot of stuff built in with her feet. And she did it on her own. She started going and getting pedicures, which seems like this. You know, like
nice touch, yeah.
But it was like this really
reworking,
this sort of like reconnecting and being not having all that.
That's great.
But it's a way of being touched too.
And it's a way of being touched by someone else. Yeah, healthy, safe touch.
Massage you and just
Okay, great. That's great. Okay, let's keep going. I guess I don't really want to do this right now about social aggression. About girls and social aggression. It's not very interesting to me anymore. You know, the whole girl fighting stuff. I'm trying to think what I want to do with it. I want to say this is that in the olden days when people started talking about social aggression and bullying, there was a lot made about sort of this binary that girls were victims or perpetrators, they were bullies or are picked on or bullied. And the current research is very different than we started out with this. For one thing, it's much more fluid than that. And a girl that is a victim today, tomorrow is mean to somebody else, often. Another element to this is that although there are very marginalized, you know, the weirdo kid that gets picked on and for her bad clothes or whatever it is, that is actually much less common in high school than kids in really heavy-duty, hierarchical jockeying with other girls who are very close to them in the social stratification. So it's not that the popular kid is picking on the marginalized kid so much. What it really is that the popular kid is picking on the kid who's just a little less popular, who's picking on, I mean, so that the pecking order, and what you're talking about, the girl drama, is around, it's a very small bandwidth, really, much more than we thought.
Right.
Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so that changes maybe a little bit how we're understanding the dynamic. It used to be, my daughter is just being picked on in school, and you know, this whole kind of thing, and that does happen.
Sure.
But she's doing stuff too, a lot of the time.
A lot of the time, and it's working in a school. I mean, it's like there's not necessarily the power. It's supposed to be a power differential. It's not that much, and it's almost impossible in some respects to handle because she did this and she did that,
right,
and nobody's there to really witness it,
right.
Objectively.
And let me say one more thing on this while I'm at it. There is no girl problem, this included, and maybe most especially this, that isn't 1,000 times worse in the adults in their environment. And one of the things we do in my generation is we talk about mean girls and bad girls and naughty girls and look at them and girls sexting. And I actually brought in, because the sexting thing drives me nuts, there's an article from a couple days ago about digital flirting in the New York Times that says that it's way worse in adults are sexting like mad.
Right.
30 to 49-year-olds, a third of 30 to 49-year-olds are doing it.
I was going to send your little handout to Congress.
Congress, yeah. But this is true with social aggression. If you, those of you that have gone to soccer games and watched what the parents are like on the sidelines, or those of you with the little kids and the birthday parties and that you're involved in not inviting this kid and doing it, inviting that kid, and you know, so we can work all we like to reduce social aggression and bullying in schools, and it's a serious issue and everything like that. But until we look at our own stuff and our own participation and our own tolerance and our own incredible eagerness to participate and or look the other way, and our own models for how we communicate indirectly with people in our relationships, I mean, they're learning it somewhere too. And they're getting it sanctioned and approved at a high level in all their environments. And if your kid's in the back seat talking to somebody and they're trash-talking some other girl, and you don't say anything and you just ask questions, God bless you, you're not gonna, you know, whatever. I mean, all I'm saying is that I have things to say about this, I understand that there's a lot of research on different interventions, but ultimately, at the end of the day, until we do our own work, we're not even beginning to address what it is that's going on in terms of the fact that we live in a culture where there are, after kindergarten and sometimes even before that, usually before that, winners and losers, ins and outs, haves and have-nots, and that gap is growing, and that the striving for social status and advantage for children at the cost to other children in every environment, schools, everywhere, homes, until we have a different way of recognizing and understanding girl behavior, they're gonna do this because they're mad, they're struggling, and they've come up with a very complicated, sophisticated way to be mad and not have it look like they're directly doing it. And the internet has been a very helpful weapon, but the internet didn't cause this.
No.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
they might be.
You know, in terms of helping them, I don't feel like, you know, I feel totally like an outsider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, I don't have a fast answer for that. I think that is a really big piece of the work with a lot of the more marginalized, lonely kids that we work with who need their peeps. To find, and it's good to find a social group that's a little more elevated than their you know, maybe what they're drawn to with whoever the, you know, reject group at school is, if that's what they feel a part of, or completely isolated. And to begin to figure out what are the social skills that she has or doesn't have, or interests that she has or doesn't have, that would open up opportunity. I'm working with a 13-year-old right now who, she looks about 9 or 10, and she's in a junior high, and she's like horrified and just so flipped out by everything that's going on there. I mean, it's just overwhelming to her. And I knew a church group, a youth church group in town that did fun activities and singing, and she likes to sing and stuff, and she's a part of this church youth group now. And a couple of those kids are in her school, but they're in other schools in the area too. And that's a nice example of finding a place for her. And that really built up her confidence. And then she joined the track team, which was amazing. And so she has, she wears the little uniform with the other track kids. And so she's come this across the course of this year. But for the first whole semester in the fall, it was a bloodbath. It was horrible. And we really worked hard to find a belonging place for her. And for those kids, that's a really big difference. You know, that makes all the difference in the world.
It's hard in schools because,
particularly in middle school.
They're like isolates, but they also, some of the kids bring some of it on themselves.
Yeah, right. Well, that's right.
And,
but it's a skill deficit.
If you want to run a social group in the school, other kid wants to be in the group with them. Whether it's girl or boy.
That's interesting.
The kids that
is this a middle school thing?
This is a middle school thing.
Because one of the things that the research shows that I'm very interested in on this is that there are often high social status girls in junior high and high school, both, even more in high school, who don't do it, who are just nice kids.
Absolutely.
And they have high social status and they're nice kids.
Absolutely.
And those are the kids that you train up in these environments to do a friendship group, mm-hmm. or to be the kids that are student leaders in the building, that are trained in saying, you know what, shut up, don't talk like that, and walking away, or saying, you don't need to talk like that, mm-hmm. so that you get a kid who has high social status who isn't going to play to step up to leadership and be supported by the adults as the leader. Schools don't have the heart for this. They have the zero tolerance for aggression, but they have a very high tolerance for social aggression. And boys are doing it too. I'm working with a 70-year-old guy right now who still cries. They pantsed him or whatever. They hung him by his locker. The guy is 70, 7-0, 7-D. I'm working with a 70-year-old man, an older man. He is 70. No, he's remembering from. I'm sorry. No wonder you're upset.
What?
This is still bad. It's still bad. It's still bad. That would be worse. Yeah. So, but he is still. It is like yesterday for him. And I said, that was, you know, 63 years ago this happened to you. And he goes, yeah. He said, it's like it was yesterday. I can remember it like it was yesterday, being hung by the locker by his underpants. So anyway, so boys do it too. And girls are participating in more direct aggression too. It's one of our big advances. is that we're having higher rates of actual aggression, but also, you know, girls are treated very differently in the juvenile justice system. They're treated much more harshly for what are called status offenses, which are offenses that if they were adults, they, you know. So running away, if you're an adult, is called traveling, right? So they're being locked up for traveling, you know, and for sexual acting out. You know, they're being punished for things that boys don't get punished for in the same way. But that's sex and sexuality, and the kind of conversations that we have as therapists and how we understand our role working with adolescent girls and with families. And how we process our own lenses around the sex and sexuality of our own times as adolescents, and as parents now, and you know, our own moral, religious, social, relational meaning making that we do, and how the kinds of conversations we have. I would say this, that things haven't changed nearly as much as one would have hoped. And that as a purely general observation, but holds quite true, is that boys are groomed for sexual entitlement, and girls are continually groomed for this total land of schizophrenia, where they are both supposed to be at once sexy and accommodating and compliant, and also responsible for gatekeeping and saying no. And for those old people like me in the room, the fact that, this is so is a sad state of affairs, and maybe even more so now than it was even in our time, where I think things were loosening up around this a little bit in the 60s and 70s. And there's been a backlash like this to what constitutes gendered behavior and popularity. So those scripts sound old as the hills, and they offer girls some pretty stunning challenges as they navigate adolescence. How are you both simultaneously passive and actively resistant? If you can answer that question, you know more than I do about this. And when we're talking about having a conversation about desire, which is markedly absent from the social policy agenda, which is about controlling girls' bodies, or for the media, in which the desire is the desire of usually males, we're not really looking at girls, what they want and don't want, and ambivalence. And girls can want to have sex, but not the consequences, which could be a bad reputation or pregnancy or diseases. They could want the consequences, which could be having someone they like them. It could be being held. It could be popularity in their social group, social acceptance, but they could not want to have the sex because it's going to hurt, and is they don't really want to do that yet. They could want to have sex and then change their minds. So when we talk about desire, which we don't ever talk about anyway very much, and those of you that have lived with adolescent girls or have any memory cells of your own adolescence left, they're sexy. There's a lot of desire going on. I thought it was particularly cruel that, you know, as our estrogen is plummeting, you know, those of us with adolescent girls, it's like a very strange estrogen dynamic in the house with teenage girls. And, you know, and we want to look like them and envy them their beautiful voluptuity, but then, you know, we want them to cover it up as hard and fast as, you know, you're not going out in that, are you, you know? So we, as parents, have this really profound fear and conflict and envy and jealousy and anger and resentment, and I don't know, right? It's like complicated too. So when we talk about whether they want it or not, even if we're having these conversations as parents or therapists or educators, what are we asking? Like, what is the conversation? And what about ambivalence? Talk about holding ambivalence. I have a big rap on oral sex, but I've also lost interest in that. I've lost interest in talking about this. There was this period of time, I think post-Bill Clinton, where there was all of these rainbow parties, there was all of this hype about that girls were, you know, in middle school were massively performing oral sex on boys on buses. And I, for my book, I researched the bejesus out of this, and this was one of these urban legends where people were just quoting themselves, you know, at some point. There was like so little truth. I mean, there was no confirmation, and also it just suggested lie all over it, because, you know, with all due respect to the lipstick industry, they were talking about these anyway. The whole thing was ridiculous, you know. And then the other thing that was ridiculous is that they did this big national survey of middle and high schoolers about giving and receiving oral sex, and both boys and girls said they were receiving more than they were giving. And that seems statistically a little bit confusing also. Yeah. All in all, I'll tell you this. Over the course of high school, kids are having more sexual activity of more kinds, including oral sex, so that seniors in high school are having a much higher frequency of sexual activity than freshmen. There are 7th and 8th graders who are sexually active. High percentage, though not all of these, are sexually abused kids, or sexually reactive kids, or unprotected kids. right? A very high percentage of the younger adolescents who are sexually involved are involved with adult men. And it is not sexual activity. It is abuse, as far as I'm concerned. And we're not viewing it properly if we see it as them being sexual. So I have thoughts and feelings about this. But one of the most recent studies that I've read, which was a very big, large-scale study, showed that they're not having as much sex as our generation did. And they're not having as much unprotected sex as we did. So it's another instance of people pretending to wring their hands about girls run wild while they're secretly being titillated and excited by it. And that when you look at what the data suggests, it's not that exciting. So if you're working with a 12 or 13-year-old girl who is sexually active, that's not typical and very concerning. And girls who get involved in sexual activity at that age are at much greater risk for all kinds of problems, including major depression. So they're very vulnerable. So, did you know all this already? Not all of it, some of it. So when we're talking about sex about girls, when we're talking about sex with girls, which we need to do and make it clear that we're willing to have this conversation, we have to hold the whole waterfront, just like I was saying with even the self-harming. Be concrete. Don't assume you know the answers or that they do either. Don't assume you even know what sex is. This has been very confusing to me, the whole hooking up thing. I travel around, I ask kids wherever I go, what is hooking up? And they all say something different. You laugh, but it is very, very confusing.
My friend asked me this the other day, my 22-year-old friend.
What is it, right? And is it everything but intercourse? Is it casual sex? Is it, you know, anyway, everywhere you go, it's different. So don't assume you know. And so if they say, I hooked up with this boy, say, what does that mean? Because I, you know, be old. Even you. Because you might think you know, but you can even say, even though I'm really young and cool and I know all about it, tell me what it means to you. I don't know. I mean, you know, you can keep your coolosity, but it's still don't assume. And don't assume it's that sexuality is about intercourse. And what are the underlying needs? Like, what's the meaning-making system? Because desire is one of the underlying needs. But I've worked with kids who are doing it for all kinds of reasons that actually have relatively little to do with intimacy and passion. I worked with a kid who just wanted to be held. And so the boy would hang around for whatever, a few minutes afterwards and hold her, and that was worth it to her. But I think part of our job is to hold the complexity, and that she could say that she's got it all figured out, but because she's bringing it in and you're in the conversation, you can say, you know what, since the beginning of time, this has been a complicated issue, and it is for all human beings. And that's part of being human, is that our sex and sexuality and gender identity and attraction and management of strong primal feelings is complicated in the context of relationships with other people. And it's even more complicated in some ways for girls because, you know, down there is kind of hidden and stuff. And, you know, and not talked about. And, you know, this is for those parents that you're dealing with. They're, you know, I mean, it's some parents. This is very, very distressing that this conversation is being had. And, you know, these dads, did you know that the average 14-year-old boy has 15 erections a day?
Oh my God. A day!
Another ew. Can you imagine? You know what's really funny? When I talk about this and there's men in the room, they say things like, that's not that many. Like that, right? And women are like, ah! Right? So imagine being a teenage boy and having to deal with that all day long.
15?
Yeah. Average.
That includes when they're sleeping.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. That's right. When they're sleeping. I'll tell you that... What? Well, I don't know. I think this is known. I mean, this is pretty widely reported. George Carlin, the comedian, had a funny rap about this. He said that he thought he desired the school bus because he would get an erection as the school bus arrived in the morning. But in any event, imagine being a teenage girl and these dads, these men in these girls' lives, they remember that. They remember wanting to hump anything that moved.
That was the
era of the perpetual erection. So, I mean, men know, obviously know that.
I had a patient a couple years ago, a guy who transgendered and had started out as a woman, and when he began taking the testosterone, at first he felt like really high and gray, and he was like, oh my God, you know, I wish I had done this thousands of years ago. This is just, I'm just feeling so high energy and great. And then after a couple weeks, he was just wanting to hump anything that moved. And he said it was just intolerable, and he didn't know if he'd go through with it. He said, so this is what guys are, you know, oh my God, being a... So it was really nice to have that conversation and kind of hear someone that was experiencing both sides of the testosterone fence. But these guys, they remember what that felt like, and that makes them pretty scared and protective of guys like them. The other thing, the last thing I want to say about that is not to assume heterosexuality. That we sometimes come in there and say, so you have a boyfriend or whatever. And that's a deal, at least in southern Vermont where I am, and you know, the girls are really much more open to at least exploring variations. And my older daughter is bisexual, and she says to me, Mom, the binary, it doesn't do anybody any good. Because I said to her, so are you a lesbian? What are you? You know, and she'll go like, you don't need the binary. You don't need it. You know, why does it have to be one or the other? It's very cool. Isn't that very cool? So it's like, okay, yeah, I'm fluid. You know, fluid sexuality. And I don't think she's alone in this. I think that actually among girls, it's another good thing about being a girl. I think girls are less stigmatized embracing that and exploring that. And so you're saying, do you have a boyfriend, really shuts down that whole piece of curiosity or, you know, okay. Couple less things. Okay, so I just want to, so any wrapping up here. But I don't need to do that. I just want to end with this, and then if people have a couple last things they want to say and fill out the forms. I think that one of the things that I want you to take home with you is not to underestimate. I mean, I hope that today you're going to come away with a sense of power and efficacy and initiative that you have something to offer these kids, even if they're pretty reluctant and resistant and mad, that your presence and confidence that you can help and that you have something specific, who you are. I mean, that it's not that I could do it and you can't. It's the specificity of who you are that really makes the difference. And that we're very childish in thinking that something technique-driven is what they need. What they need is something real and sustained and deepening that has in it hope and curiosity. And I love this Bruno Bettelheim quote, you know, because he was in a concentration camp. And he said, we all survive on trust and hope, not on fact. And so when you're working with adolescents who and families who are really stuck and despairing, and you say to yourself, oh my gosh, these people need therapy or something. This is hopeless. Just know that the facts of people's lives, if we really dealt with the facts of our lives, we'd never get out of bed in the morning. And some people don't, but most of us do. And the family that's there, the girl that's there in your room, she got out of bed this morning to come see you. That's hopeful in and of itself. So I want to just bow to you because you're doing great work and it's important work, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.